Hello and good afternoon. Welcome to our Bench of Law Meetup webinar. This is our 1 year anniversary of these monthly webinars. And this month we are addressing compensation and recruiting basics for startups. With me, I have a few subject matter experts as well as one of my colleagues, Matt Sechrist. So I have Jim Anderson from SearchPath of Wall Street, who is a recruiter in the tech industry, and Jennifer Matkin from Matkin Compensation Consulting, who works with emerging companies in the Cleveland area, getting their compensation right. Many of you have heard me present before. I'm up counsel in the corporate department at Squire Patton Boggs. Primarily work with emerging companies and have spent, quite a few years in my career working in-house at startups in early stage companies. And I'll turn next to Jim and let him introduce himself.
Thanks, Leah. My name is Jim Anderson. I'm with SearchPath of Wall Street. SearchPath is a national talent management, talent acquisition, and recruiting firm. I've been in the tech business, not so much recruiting, for about well over 30 years. And my role with the company is really working with clients to help them develop their staff and staff plans. And then we have another part of our organization that helps with the recruiting side to bring the talent to bear based on the requirements that customers have.
And Jennifer, can I ask you to provide a short introduction of yourself as well? Jennifer?
Yes, this is Jennifer Matkin. Thank you for the introduction. And yes, as Leah said, I do work with emerging companies in the Cleveland area. And what I try to do is work with you to develop some custom pay solutions tailored to your needs and with an efficient, cost-effective delivery. So we're able to mark-to-market jobs in your industry and for your startup company and develop some compensation structures as you evolve your business so that you're providing competitive pay in a way that actually works with your organization, its cash flow and financials. So thank you, Leah.
Oh, thank you, Jennifer. And Matt, do you want to say a few words?
Sure. This is Matt Sechrist. I'm with Squire Patton Boggs. I'm an employee benefits generalist. So basically, I help companies with legal compliance with all their employee benefits matters, from stock options, severance packages, compensation packages, just generally how people get paid. I deal with the legal compliance in that area.
Yeah. I want to thank all of you for helping with this month's webinar and the live event that we did on Friday. I think this really benefits from all of your expertise. Next, I want to say just a quick thank you to all of the co-sponsors to this event. So Squire Patton Boggs doesn't do this by ourselves. We have 13 different co-sponsors that help promote our event locally and nationally. Why don't we just go ahead and dive right in? We're talking about compensating employees, and maybe we should just start from the beginning. Just a question out to Jim. At the beginning, how do you find that top talent that your company needs? And, when do the conversations start with you?
Sure. So I've been in the industry for a long time, and what I mean is I mean the tech industry, and have done built a lot of staffs in companies I've worked for, and I have gone through the whole process of hiring and talent, or finding talent to staff my organizations in the industries that I've been in. And in finding them, I've used a lot of techniques, but the most efficient I've found is working with a recruiter, really, that is familiar with your industry, familiar with your business, as opposed to doing it yourself. Many companies do attempt to do it themselves, and there's a lot of resources out there today, on the web, especially, LinkedIn and Dice and Indeed and some other ones that are out there. And it's a very time-consuming process, and I can speak from the standpoint of being in a number of startups. what I found is I just didn't have the time to weed through and look through and research all of the candidates that I needed to hire. So I found it best to work at least up front with a recruiter to help me build a plan or address a plan for going about the hiring process or the talent acquisition process itself. The other thing is you need to know, I think, you need to have a plan, and we're going to talk a little bit later about this. You need to build that pipeline, and you need to build that pipeline before you need the talent. So it's important that as part of your strategy within your business, that you're looking and building a pipeline of potential candidates based on your hiring requirements, which are part of your whole business plan. And you should have a time frame and a budget and start building those candidates and start building those relationships potentially with some candidates you could be interested in bringing into your company in the future.
Thanks a lot, Tim. I guess at what point in your experience do you see companies starting to reach out to you? And before you answer, just, I start working with companies sometimes as early as before they actually form the company, and we just have a couple of founders. But at some point, those founders run out of their network. They also need to raise money. And I guess my question goes back to when do people start talking to you, but also, when should they start talking to you?
Okay, yeah. Well, a lot of them start talking to us the minute that they know that they have a requirement for talent. I'll just call it talent in general. It might be one person. It might be a dozen people. But that's typically where we see companies, especially startups, come to us, and they've already exhausted their effort, or they've already become frustrated with their effort, possibly, in finding the talent they're looking for, because the market's so competitive out there today. When should they be talking to us? I can speak from experience once again on that. It doesn't cost anything to talk to a recruiter. When you start talking about investment and using a service for bringing in your talent, that's when you're going to have to start talking price and how much it's going to cost. But beforehand, helping you build that plan and helping you understand the market for your talent is something that most recruiters are very, very specialized at. And that's when you should start talking to a recruiter, start identifying a recruiter that fits best in your industry and for your purposes, the type of people you're hiring. So it's almost like recruiting a recruiter. You should know, you should have your recruiters targeted so that you're ready to go when you are ready to begin hiring, and if you are eventually going to be using a recruiter to hire those people.
And Jim, I think you talked before on Friday about you want to find a recruiter with a good talent pipeline, because one of the questions I think was asked was, well, what's the real time frame? And we couldn't really tell anyone what a good time frame is to start to finish. Like, is it 3 months for a typical hire? Is it 2 months? Is it a month to find somebody to hire them? Because we really couldn't give a good answer to that. But I think what we came out on Friday is just a recruiter with a good talent pipeline, an established recruiter. I think that's what people really need to look for.
Absolutely, it's critical, and it's critical when you start to evaluate if you're starting at the right time. When you start evaluating the recruiter or recruiters that you're going to use in your process, most recruiters will tell you they have a great pipeline, but that might not be the case all of the time. And that's part of evaluating your recruiter that you potentially are going to use. You should, get a feel for the pipeline or the base of recruits that they have today within their backlog.
And we also talked about how to compensate a recruiter. And we talked about, like, on Friday, just, like, a variety of ways, like a percentage of the salary or compensating a recruiter in stock options even. So we talked about that too.
Yeah, for instance, my organization, we get pretty creative with the compensation model that we ask for, especially when we are working with startups, understanding their capacity to spend, the amount of money that they have in the bank, and a lot of startup companies just don't have the capital available to them right away. So we work with a number of startups in creative ways. Stock options, as you mentioned, Matt, is one way. Also, doing deferred billing and things like that are other ways that we work with them. But there's probably 100 ways to Sunday that we can, we can work with a customer to be compensated.
And I want to turn to something you said, Jim, and that's the talent acquisition plan and how that should be part of your business plan early on, long before you're actually acquiring that needed talent. And kind of filling out that what that talent acquisition plan is, we have the hire that we need to make next, or the next few hires that we need to make. But then turning to Jennifer, how do we know how much money we need to pay those people?
Right, that's a great question. And a lot of times, as leading a startup, you try to do everything yourself, and you reach out to your network. You might search online for available databases to tell you how jobs pay. And that can be an easy reference to go to, but those references that are available to you for free online are self-reported data from other employees, and they aren't always the most helpful pieces of information, especially because people don't always know how to self-report their pay, especially when it comes to equity. So having a resource as myself available to you, I actually have at my fingertips databases that I have subscriptions to that are statistically valid, great data in your industries, and I can actually cut it by industry and geography to say, here's what these jobs pay in the marketplace. Now let's have a conversation to how we tailor that competitive pay to your organization based on how much base salary you can afford, how much equity you're considering, and those types of things. And understanding that the cash flow is what it is at certain points of the evolution of a startup, we can always find some efficient way to do some fixed pricing to do that and turn it around very quickly for you so that you can make an intelligent decision about competitive pay.
And one thing we talked about last week, Jennifer, was, if you want to compensate people and employees in equity, one thing the startup should look at is how are they going to pay on that equity? So we could tailor it to the specific job duty. So, for example, if they're finishing a task and you know that task is going to result in an influx in cash, we can put together sort of a compensation package so that when they're done, we know there's this cash that's going to be there that we can pay on that equity that we're granting people.
Agree. That's a great point. Thank you.
Yeah. So it's really, just going to your point, it's all about there's a lot of flexibility in the compensation practice, and it's really there's no one-size-fits-all. It's all it's very flexible. That's one great thing about a startup. You can have a lot of flexibility here as far as how you're going to recruit and retain people.
And I'm going to throw in the standard lawyer word of caution. If the task is raising money, you can't pay upon the raising of money as a percentage of what's raised without some securities licenses that take quite a bit of expertise to attain.
Exactly. So it's always good to work with your partners.
Sorry about that.
No, that's very true.
So I think, what I would say, pulling the bits and pieces together is, proactively, if I'm in the position of starting a company, it's a great idea to have this part of my business plan where I've mapped out who the first 5 or who the first 10 hires are, depending on how fast my business is growing. How do I find those people? How much do I pay those people? One thing, and this might be specific to the Midwest where we're sitting right here, right now, but what if that talent's not locally available to me? How do I find them, get them to work for me? How do I know how to pay them if it's different than the amount I would have to pay someone with the same talent in my local area? Jim or Jennifer, whoever wants to jump in.
I'll comment on that a bit. One of the advantages, we run into these situations as recruiters all the time, and although we might search for talent, let's say for the Cleveland market, our search will still be conducted nationally, and we'll come up with scenarios and situations with our clients about how to address talent that we'd like to hire, and where they're located in the country, and whether you are working with them remotely or you're looking for a relocation package. So you need to, have an idea if you're, open to offering relocation if we happen to look for that talent outside of the boundaries, and also if you're, not open to remote work. And there's certain, obviously, there's certain skills and certain positions that you aren't open to in terms of having them work remote. But if you are paying remote employees, for instance, if you're in Cleveland, you're hiring an engineer out of Austin, Texas, most likely, 9 times out of 10, you are going to have to compensate that engineer based on the market that he lives in today, which would be Austin, Texas, for example. So that's what we find most of the time. Very rarely do we find talent that's outside the market that works remotely that's willing to accept the pay of somebody that's actually in your market, in your headquarters market.
Yeah, that's a great point, Jim. And with the data that I can provide to you on competitive pay, I can show it by industry, but also geographic location, because what you would pay in Austin, Texas may very well be different than in Cleveland versus San Francisco and what have you. And it's important for you to know to make your decision on how you want to pay someone.
Well, thank you. And I think, going from that planning for hiring people to being successful when you do hire people, do you guys have advice for the do's and the don'ts to how to make the most successful hire for the company?
I'll comment on that very quickly, and then Jennifer, I'll let you provide some input on that as well. I'm big on making sure, and I've done this in my experience in my past. I've experienced it both ways, where we've onboarded people with no onboarding plan. And I think on the previous slide, we mentioned having an assimilation plan, a 30, 60, 90-day type of plan for onboarding an employee. But what I find in many companies is the onboarding processes are weak, and those can affect the performance as well as the satisfaction of that employee that you bring on board. So I can't encourage any more that, you must have that onboarding plan if you're going to bring somebody in and assimilate them into the company successfully. Jennifer, did you have anything on that?
Yes. Yeah, thank you. And I would also suggest that sometimes when a startup is beginning to hire and getting some momentum going, it's very easy to hire who you can, throw the money at them as you need, and get them on board as fast as possible. That can actually bite you in the back end, because as your business evolves, you may realize that how you structured the pay and how much pay you're delivering does not fit your go-forward strategy and your go-forward structure. And it can actually become a challenge and cost you even more money to try to unwind that in some way. So the idea is, if you set up a methodology to mark to market and then figure out how strategically you want to pay people, how much in base, how much in equity, et cetera, by position, then you can make some smart decisions as you make hires on how to pay them so it fits your structure currently and can evolve into the future, as opposed to being an issue causing you to be even more cash strapped because you threw too much money on early in the engagement.
And on that note of evolving into the future, Jennifer, you've been doing this for about 30 years. How often do you see companies kind of reassessing, especially as the company moves from a startup to a larger company, reassessing what their initial employees' pay are based on new job duties that they may have acquired?
Right, because it's really important that we engage early to understand the wants and needs of the organization and set that pay structure and philosophy that we're going to follow as we add new employees. As a startup hits certain points of inflection as it's evolving, we're going to need to double check that to make sure mark-to-market makes sense, that's how people's skills and responsibilities may have evolved over time. We want to make sure that we're paying them competitively and in a way that makes sense so it's mutually beneficial to the firm as well as the employee. So I'd say at certain points of inflection, and probably no less than every 6 months in the early stages, that we're doing some checks to make sure that the compensation remains relevant, it makes sense to the organization, is mutually beneficial.
Hey, Jennifer, one thing that came, one question we had last week was, say we have a startup that actually did throw a lot of money at people. How would you handle that as far as the restructuring of the pay?
Yeah, that's a great point, because that can and has happened where, you know, the board starts telling the CEO, hey, the compensation expense is too great relative to the number of jobs that you have, and now you want to hire more. That doesn't make sense. So a great process would be I could mark to market your jobs and figure out where the pay differential is, where the quote-unquote overpayment might be. If it's marginal and something we can live with, that's fine. And where it's not, we need to take a step back and figure out how meaningful that is to us. So the idea is we start with a blank sheet of paper, mark to market the jobs, and then layer in the actual individuals after that to figure out the pay differential, where we're on market, where we're slightly above market, and where we're way above market. And on that way above, we have to really sit back and take a look at that talent to figure out, is that the talent that will help you carry your startup forward, or is that something you need to reassess about the talent before you make any decisions on how to modify the pay structure?
And I want to say, you know, I don't often see a lot of companies being that aware and that proactive. But in what I do a lot of investment transactions where investors are coming in for the first or the second time. A lot of times, the first time a big strategic investor comes in, and having that story and that thoughtfulness about how the compensation is done prior to that first serious investor coming in, from my perspective, will do a lot of benefit for the company to reserving their pay structure, and, you know, showing that they're serious and thoughtful people to that investor. It gives them some benefit in the due diligence process, or positive benefit in the due diligence process. I'd ask Matt as well, because we work on a lot of companies together, and we might see a lot more of the don'ts than the do's.
Yeah, exactly. So it's really important from not just a legal perspective, but as just practically running your company, that you have documentation in place to say, these are the awards that we granted in our stock plan. These are the options. Don't do it on a paper napkin. Don't do it on a napkin. Do it, actually have an award agreement. Have someone draft the documents that knows what goes into the decision to grant awards, and make sure you have a good cap table that lists all your awards, because it's like Leah is alluding to, when you get to those stages where you have investors or you're looking to sell the company, you really need to have a clean documentation. Otherwise, it can really stall or basically it could kill a deal, basically, if you don't have proper documentation in place.
I agree, and I think, you know, what I would typically say is you don't raise red flags where you don't need to. So there's hurdles that you're going to have to get over to have investors believe that they want to give you their money and buy a part of your company. And there's a lot of unnecessary hurdles that companies put in front of themselves by not paying attention or following up on the administrative part of the duties of giving compensation. To Matt's plan of adopt a stock option plan, if you're going to tell employees that you're giving them stock options, have your board meet to approve the grant of stock options before the stock options are granted. You know, it's a process, and this is in kind of the startup world and the administrative documentation world, this is one of the few processes that you can't fix later because it's very much tax rule driven. So I'm only going to pitch in for the scary stuff that I see, typically. But you know, I want to address another point. I think a lot of times in the early stages of a company, there's two types of employees that you can get. One are the young employees that are willing to do anything, but they actually don't yet have any expertise in any specific area. And the second are the older, you know, want to make a mark in their, make a mark in the world before their career is over. So they've already done the big job. They've already made enough money, but they want to do something good and they believe in your technology. So maybe, Jim, if you have any comments about how you differentiate the two and with when one might be better than the other when you're ensuring which type of employee fits your company best.
Right. Yeah, I think it's important that, honestly, if you're a startup company, it's very difficult to onboard or to hire somebody without the experience that they need to have. So that's one of the don'ts or one of the bullet points about don't hire inexperienced candidates and attempt to train them, because I'll guarantee you, you probably don't have the time to train them, and it's, they're not going to come up to speed in the market or in the industry the way you want to them, the way you want them to on their own. So a lot of the first hires that you do see, and I've experienced in companies, is, you know, bringing in an experienced professional, somebody who understands the market, who's been in that industry before. Even though you're going to pay probably quite a bit more than you would for somebody without that experience, the pay is worth hiring the experienced as opposed to hiring the inexperienced. Once you have a mature staff and a mature organization, bringing in the less experienced people, yes, will save you money, of course, and will be allow you to, you know, groom and mold an employee into the type of employee you want working for your company. But at the get-go, it can be a big mistake by a startup to bring in a lot of inexperienced workers and attempt to train them, because you know, as you know, as an owner or a founder in a startup, you're wearing a lot of hats, and you just don't have that time to spend with an inexperienced resource to try to train them.
Ian, you have to keep in mind that you do get what you pay for. So when you bring in someone who's a little more experienced, they tend to have greater bandwidth and have greater experience in multiple dimensions. So as your organization is fluid on the talent that it might need, and they might be able to actually fill more roles on an ad hoc basis than you may initially realize.
That's very true.
And Jim, I just thought, you know, we had discussed when we were preparing for this, you know, going back to the different ways that an emerging company can work with your company. Let's say we're in the more experienced worker pool, but you don't need them for 100% of the time or for a very long, you know, term. I believe you had said that they could actually hire them on as a consultant that you guys hold as an employee.
Very true, and we do a lot of, if you want to call it subcontracting, for lack of a better word for it, we do hire out or manage what we call fractional employees, and a lot of times these fractional employees are senior-level people. Some of them are even senior-level, you know, C-level people, CMOs, CFOs, COOs, and things like that. In fact, it's a very popular trend today in terms of being able to bring in the more experienced people, the senior-level folks on a fractional or a part-time basis. And for startups, obviously, that makes a lot of sense. And there's a lot of talented individuals in the market today that are actually working for multiple startup organizations on a fractional basis. So instead of paying a senior-level individual with 25, 30 years of experience, you know, $200,000 or $300,000 a year in compensation, you're only paying that person as you need them and pay-as-you-go type of model.
Yeah,
Yeah. And what you want to do too, just from a tax perspective, this is very common as far as using consultants, but you want to make sure that you work with someone experienced like Jim, because a trap for the unwary is these could be considered, might be considered your employees, and you have employment tax withholding obligations that you might not have met. So you want to work with someone experienced like Jim if you want to hire these outside type consultants.
Yeah, and I would say, if these people are in California would be extra wary, because there's a lot of recent case law and there are a lot of fines that stack up very quickly in California, but that's not the only state where this is a high-level item. One of the benefits of hiring the employees, as Jim was mentioning, through his company, and you know, several companies do this, is that they are employees of record of somebody, and what you're doing is you're hiring a company name to provide a service, even though that service is done by the individual with the expertise that you need. Skipping forward in the slides a little bit, backwards in time, it's a cash-strapped startup idea, and that's really the basis of a lot of this is, we're looking proactively, and we're sitting here as service providers kind of saying you need to do X, Y, and Z rather than doing it yourself. I guess I would ask Jim and Jennifer, Matt as well, to kind of, if you have any comments on how does a company utilize your services but optimize their spend so that really they're spending the right amount but not hurting their bank account by utilizing our services?
Right, and this is Jennifer. For compensation purposes, one of the best ways to work together is initially when you're starting to do the first 1, 2, 3, 4 hires, we can work together to mark to market to make sure you know what competitive pay is. We can figure out how much to deliver on base and performance pay. Maybe that performance pay is equity, maybe it's cash, what have you. What kind of structure works with you for those first 1 to 10 hires? And we could just do an easy flat rate, 24, 72-hour turnaround, depending on the complexity of the job. To keep you moving, you can make those hires. As we're working together and learning your business, as you reach a fulcrum point where you need to develop more infrastructure, that's where we've already known each other. We've already done some work together. We know how jobs are priced and what jobs you might have. We can actually work together to phase in a more formal compensation structure for you that supports your flexibility and evolution, that supports your expense structure, and work together in phases as you startup goes through its own phases, and work together on a flat rate basis to help you put together that structure so it's transparent and consistent within your organization.
Yeah, I would say it's not really like a 1, 2, 3 step. It's really all working in conjunction with each other, because you have Jim who's looking for the people, Jennifer who's figuring out what to pay the people, and then you have legal who's making sure everything's documented properly. So where legal would come in is if you want to do an equity plan, we put together an equity plan document for you and then a form award agreement. And then you can run with that form award agreement when you're granting awards to people, making sure at the same time that when you're granting future awards under your equity plan, either stock options, restricted stock, or some sort of equity compensation, that you're following that plan document. And then from a legal perspective, we can also help out with any employment agreements if you want to have people sign employment agreements or your offer letters. Just kind of work together as sort of a team approach. That's the way you got to look at it. Everyone's part of the overall team.
Yeah, and if I could just say the whole idea around employee retention and being flexible, being creative, being agile in your hiring and as well as your retention of your employees, it's so important, especially in today's market. The minute you bring in a resource or you hire somebody, keep in mind, your competition's probably looking at them too. and potentially vying for their services even after you've made that hire. So you got to keep it in mind. You got to incent your employees. You got to use some creativity in how you manage your employees, and you know, continue to review the employer-employee relationship that you have.
And I want to say a couple more words on the legal side of things, because inevitably, whether or not you ever talk to Jim or talk to Jennifer or someone with their type of roles, in a startup company that's going to be successful, either in the short term or the long term, is always going to talk to lawyers, because they're raising money, they're getting investments, they're entering into strategic partnerships, et cetera. But in my view, there's two times in which you spend money with lawyers. One is at the beginning when you're starting up your company, and you're starting up all your form documents, so you have that form of offer letter that you always hand out, or that form of, you know, stock option agreement that you always hand out and get approved. And then you have when you're going into the strategic investment round, and you're paying for your lawyers to kind of help you look good and negotiate the best documents for you. And a lot of the don'ts, you know, that Matt mentioned, that I might have mentioned, that we see is really in that realm of things where we're fixing things because a founder, in the early stage decided to save time, save money, et cetera, and cut corners by not doing the proper documentation. And we've seen it as late as someone selling the company and they discovered that every stock option they thought they had granted actually didn't exist. And that has pretty big tax consequences for the people who thought that they had ownership in the company. And there's ways to kind of fix it so they get some benefit, but you can't fix the tax. Like, either they get taxed the way the IRS will tax on a long-term basis, or they get taxed on a short-term basis. You can't just say, I forgot to file a document, so can you please just give them long-term?
Yeah, I'll just add that, Leah. So it's the old saying, garbage in, garbage out. So you want to make sure you have good documentation in place. And some just general tips when you're talking about options is have an expiration date in your option. So, you know, when you grant these options, you got to be able to track them. So if you don't have an expiration date in your option, say someone left maybe 10 years ago, you forgot about that option. You might have not realized this person had an option. Then they pop out of the blue. So you want to make sure that you have clear expectations when you're doing your documentation, and everything should be close to the form option agreement. You can vary from your option agreement, but don't vary too much. Try to make your life easier. Don't make your life too difficult by saying these options never expire and then having these people pop up 20 years later or something when you're trying to sell the company and you're scrambling to figure out what's going on with these options that you completely forgot about granting.
Right, and I guess to Matt's point, so even if you do the option wrong from a board approval perspective, at the end of the day, it has two signatures on the bottom of it. It's the person receiving it and the company issuing it, and it's a contract between those two parties, even if it's not done correctly. So that person who expects that they have an ownership in your company, whether or not you did it right, has an ability to sue you based on a document that you signed. And so we have to take care of it when we get to the investment stage or an acquisition stage of the company so that it doesn't harm the ability for your company to get investment or to get acquired. Yeah. And it costs more. The legal spend is more the more we have to clean up at that stage. Another point I want to make on just, you know, it's, the company's cash-strapped at the beginning. They're, you know, figuring out the pay correctly with Jennifer. They're figuring out the right person to hire correctly with Jim. They're doing their documents in the right form with us. but they still want to minimize their spend on money. And I think there's ways in how Jennifer's helping, you know, determine what that compensation should be, where you're not really spending as much cash out of your bank account, but you're giving other things to the employees that are valuable. And maybe Jennifer could speak a little bit to that.
Yes, thank you for the segue. And as we mentioned before, sometimes when you hire more experienced workers, they can also provide some internal capability of mentoring and knowledge transfer. So that is, you know, a free for the people who might be a little less experienced to actually have that occur. And it's something that people really value in their careers, that someone could take them under their wing and do that kind of knowledge transfer. There are also some things you can do on a pre-tax earnings basis that you could provide to people, including some, you know, flexibility, some services. People really appreciate job titles. You don't want to overinflate them, but at the same time, you're a startup and they're, you know, the new 1, 2, 3, 4 number of employees, and job titles really don't cost you anything. Frequent performance communications are priceless, letting people know where they're meeting expectations, what you need them to pivot to, how you're evolving, and having great open communications people really value. And there's also some opportunities for some performance-based retention bonuses based on your cash ability and when it might be available. Those types of things that people value, and also gives you kind of that retention hook for individuals as well.
Thanks, Jennifer. And I would say, in my startup company experience, one of the most effective things that I ever worked with was a quarterly bonus program rather than an annual one. So every quarter, your supervisor got to come in, tell you how, got to do a performance review, and you got a small amount of money, which ultimately was less than what an annual bonus might have been, but you felt good because every 3 months you got a check. And our employees loved it. We do have one question that came that got posted, and I think this one is really great for Jim to answer. Let me read it. It says, in my experience, startups require people who can work without a large company structure and resources, who are very entrepreneurial, creative, and self-driven. How do you recommend to identify such people and compensate them? I've seen very experienced people from large pharma being totally lost and not helpful in a small startup. And at the same time, recruiters and founders initially go after such people because of their large pharma experience and pay a ton for that experience.
Yeah, that's a great question, and it's I'm glad you directed it to me, because I can once again speak from my own experience on this. I came from a very large software company. I worked at a very large software company for over a decade, and about 10 years ago, I turned my targets towards smaller software companies, smaller startups, and so I lived that whole corporate life. I lived the ridiculous bureaucracy and politics that you deal with in large companies, and I got out of that. I got out of that corporate life because I desired more control, more flexibility, and less politics, which startups and smaller firms bring to you. And there's a lot of folks out there that are very experienced that are looking for that kind of career change. And I do agree with you, but unfortunately, there's a lot of people that have been in these large organizations that just can't break them out of the mold. they get turned into those corporate employees who expect to have, you know, while they deal with the bureaucracy and the politics, but they also have all the structure underneath them that they lean on to be able to succeed in their jobs. So in finding the type of people, I don't discourage you. I highly encourage you to look at the large organizations to find the senior level or experienced people in your industry. However, it's very important that you vet or interview and understand the background of this person thoroughly to make sure that they're going to fit into your culture. So that's one of the things that we try to ensure whenever we bring a resource in for an interview for a client. we We do a very thorough background check, and I'm not talking about the background check from criminal and all that kind of stuff. We do that as well, but our biggest and most important thing is that we can find somebody that will fit culturally in the organization. So we try very hard to understand your culture and what you're looking for, and we try to match that with the experience, the background, and if you want to call it the culture of the individual that we're bringing in. So that's how, one of the ways to address it. It's not easy to find that type of person and to find somebody who'll fit your culture. So it's important that you spend a lot of time checking the background, the resources, and understanding the person that you want to bring into the company.
And I think the saying that goes with that is the slow to hire, fast to fire.
Right. Yeah, and it can be slow to hire, but we try to cut down the burden of trying to find that right person, because it can take a long time to find the people. We have a team of people that have large networks, know a lot of people, have a lot of candidates actually that we work for. So we can find those people quicker because we know most of the candidates that we have in our pipeline, we know very well. And we know friends and friends of friends and friends of the candidates too. So we can cut down that burden or that timeline in finding that type of person so that, it doesn't take long to hiring. And hopefully it's not going to be a short period of time before you have to fire them, because we do bring the right person in for you.
I agree. I guess one question I want to ask you, Jim, and this may be my personal bias, but I guess how would you differentiate between the person that a company can find on Indeed or another job posting website? So it's the person who is looking for a job versus the person who is recruited away from the job that they're currently sitting at.
Yeah, we tend to focus that's kind of what differentiates us from a job board, like Indeed or even LinkedIn. We typically focus on what we call passive type of candidates. And these are folks that are already working in jobs. And as opposed to finding somebody or looking at somebody who's out of a job or has been out of a job for many months or maybe even out of the market for years, we try to focus on the passive candidates, not the job seekers. And I think that's what you end up finding on Indeed, and other types of job boards many times, are those that are looking for a job because either they're out of work, for various reasons, or they're just job jumpers. They jump to the next best offer they find. And there's a lot of people that are in the market that are like that as well, that they go from job to job to job. Because they're just, they're looking for the highest paying employer and not so much the best environment or the best type of industry to work in.
And then from your experience, I guess once you place somebody in a job, how long would you like to see them stay in that job to call it a successful placement? And then I'll ask Jennifer after you answer if she can give some comp tips on how to get them to stay longer.
Yeah, we hope that they're in their when we place them, but we hope we're placing them in there for the long run, and that's why we spend a lot of time doing our homework and bringing the right candidate into a situation. We're just not going to throw a bunch of resumes at you and let you do the vetting of those candidates. We're going to vet them, those candidates, and we want to bring the person who's going to be in there for the long haul. That's what we're looking for. And there's really no timeline. It's really your timeline, the timeline of, especially being a startup, the timeline you have set for your company. Potentially, do you have a 3 or 4 or 5 year exit for your company, or do you plan on staying in business for a long time and building the company up? So it's important to understand that, and that's one thing that we spend a lot of time to doing also, is understanding your company and the strategy and the position of your company, so that we can properly put the right candidate in, but also properly present and position your company with the candidates.
I guess, and Jennifer, I guess I'll ask for your comments. So once that person is positioned in the company, you've worked with the company to get the right initial compensation, what are strategies a company can work through to maintain and retain their employees, at least from a compensation perspective?
Right, that's important. Now that we selected the right person for the right role and we're paying them competitively, you want to make sure that that pay is also reflective of their performance as their performance evolves over time, but also the job responsibilities, because in a startup, they may have broad responsibilities early and then might tailor or vice versa depending on the needs of your startup. And you want to make sure that that competitive pay is aligned with their performance and also how their job is changing over time. And I would really encourage elements of pay for performance. You do need a base salary because people have various obligations to live on, and you want to make sure that's somewhat competitive. But where you really want to be competitive is on that pay for performance piece. Maybe it's certain cash every quarter or on an annual basis, that equity piece tied to maybe a patent or some other pay performance metric that people can feel good about when they attain it, and you can celebrate it, and it keeps encouraging them. So a lot of times we'll actually schedule out pay as to when pay is changed and how frequently and what increments, those types of things, because so people are, as I say, feeling the love with some frequency when you have good performers or high performers, and especially the rock star that you might have, which is a good thing to have. But you kind of schedule out when they might be tapped with various pay, and you have to marry all that with your cash flow and financials. It's a delicate balance, but I think if it's thoughtful and thoughtful proactively, then people will feel that you are looking out for them, and it's just not all about your organization, but it's a mutually beneficial compensation structure.
Matt, do you have anything to add to that from what you're seeing doing the legal work for that pay?
No, it's basically just aligned with what Jennifer was saying. We can. It's all about flexibility and whether what you're putting forth as far as expectations for the employee, whether that's really going to incentivize them or not. So, for example, you can grant all the stock options you want, but if you're not paying on those stock options, it doesn't look like you're going to pay on those stock options. That's not really going to be an incentive for a person to stay. So you need to have real incentive for people to work hard and stay long. So that's where you partner with a compensation consultant like Jennifer to make sure what you're putting together is actually of some substance and some reward to employees.
Okay, and we have another question, and hopefully, Matt, you can answer. If not, I will do my best. So the question is, startups often have intense periods of work, especially early in the process. What is the practical difference between an exempt and a non-exempt employee, and how do we minimize the need to pay overtime pay?
Sure, no problem. That's more of an employment lawyer question rather than my area. But generally, you can look at your salary people or your management people, the people who need the less supervision, and then your hourly people are people who aren't in like the management role. This is more of a question for an employment lawyer, but that's a general sense. And what you can do, actually, there's the IRS has a helpful guide on its website where you can actually look and it'll tell you the factors that tell someone should be exempt versus not exempt. So you can actually go on the IRS.gov website and you can click on the link, the search box there, and you can find like a helpful guide the IRS puts out.
If that person is a non-exempt employee, which means that you have to pay them on an hourly basis, one of the kind of big ticket items these days is everybody has a smartphone and they always check their email. The non-exempt employees that are paid hourly should have no expectation from their job to do any email outside of job hours. And if you can, stop them from getting their email, because this is an area where you could later be subject to paying a lot of back pay for overtime, especially if their manager expected them to email back late at night or on weekends. And that's, you know, it's really a hot ticket item these days with non-exempt workers.
Yep, it's true. You can also go on the DOL's website, too. They also have some fact sheets as well in addition to the IRS that is kind of helpful in this regard. But
and that's the Department of Labor. So you would look at whichever state you're located in, type in that state name in the Department of Labor plus exempt versus non-exempt into Google, and you should get a fact sheet.
Yeah.
But usually people with graduate-level degrees that are in managerial-type positions that are really responsible and have job ownership over what they do fall squarely into the exempt realm.
Yeah, exactly. And you want to just be careful here because there can be serious penalties, especially in states like California, where you just want to make sure you classify your employees correctly. When you're dealing with, I would generally feel confident to say, like, if you're dealing with highly technical people, like doctors, engineers, that they would be more in the salaried range for their work rather than hourly. But you know, you've got to do the analysis first before you jump to that. But that's just a little bit of help there.
Right. Yeah. Thank you. And we're just running out of time, so I'll ask for a couple of parting words from each of you. So can I start with you, Jim?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'll only spend a couple seconds here. So I know there's a lot of misconceptions out there in the market about working with recruiters like myself, but it can pay and provide a lot of benefits for startups. And what you need to understand, and I said this earlier in the process, that it doesn't cost you anything to talk to a recruiter. So if you're building your startup plan or you're well evolved in your startup business but don't really have a hiring plan, call me or talk to me or talk to any recruiter who you can get involved with who can help you build that plan and build that roadmap for your talent going forward. The only time we ever ask for money is when we bring that talent to bear for you or bring that talent and you hire them. And that's the only thing I will say as my parting words.
any parting words from you, Jennifer?
Yes, I would say that pay matters. What we pay for matters and how we pay matters. And having a thoughtful strategy at the beginning about how that pay will manifest itself in your startup will save you much time and energy as your startup evolves over time. And having good partners, such as those on the phone here, can help you along the way.
Yeah, I'll just add, it's all about your partners. You got to identify good people that you're going to work with and know their area, and then just make sure from my perspective, from a legal perspective, make sure you've got good documentation from the start and you maintain that documentation. Again, I like to always say garbage in, garbage out, so make sure that you have somebody that you're comfortable with that can give you a good baseline to start with and just that you can maintain that good baseline. Start from a good place. Don't try to start and then try to fix things down the road.
Yeah, and I would echo that. Don't raise the red flags where you don't need to and do the boring administrative work of keeping the documentation up with the employees that you hire and that you continue to compensate so that they can get the compensation that they expect when you have a successful event in your company. And, you know, also Jennifer had made a point about doing employee reviews, and I know there's a million things to do on a startup, but to keep an employee engaged and interested, you have to be interested in them. It's worth the time, and the person that has to drive that it's worth the time and effort is always at the top of the company. So the founders, the CEO, need to find that it's important to communicate with the employees, and the employees will stay. So thank you, everybody, for joining. You know, really appreciate all of the questions provided. Thank you to Jennifer and to Jim for all of your expertise and for helping out in the presentation. Next month, we will be talking about connecting and engaging with investors with a couple of guest speakers from Skoda Minotti. So, thank you, everyone.
This concludes today's call. Thank you for your participation. You may now disconnect.